The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening. My name is Andrea, for those of you who I haven't met yet. Last week, when I talked about this notion of things as they are. And at the end of the talk, I was particularly pointing to a translation of the term that's often translated as things as they are, yata bhuta. I was talking about a translation of the term things, or as it actually is, and pointing to the fact that the actually part points to this idea that we often have experiences, or we often filter our experiences through views, through opinions, through beliefs. And that is what I'd like to talk about more this evening, this idea of views. So in terms of things that obscure things as they are, views is one of the most predominant. There are different kinds of views. There are views about who we are and what we think we're capable of. And there's views about the world that we hold. I'm sure you all have your own version of who you are, the version of the view of who you are. It might take the form of beliefs about particular habits of mind that are pretty entrenched, that I'm the kind of person who X, I'm the kind of person who gets angry a lot, or I'm the kind of person who doesn't get angry, or I'm the kind of person who fill in the blank. Also, in terms of views about ourselves, these often come in the form of things that we think we can do or can't do. Views about the world also have a variety of forms. They might come in the form of kind of personal views about how we think other people should behave, how we think our spouses or partners should behave, how we think our children should behave, how we think our friends and coworkers should behave. The views can also come in the more societal form. They can actually be personal or societal, this form of something along the lines of, I have something, therefore I deserve it. Or I don't have something, therefore I don't deserve it. Or perhaps something along the lines of, you have something that I don't have, and I deserve to have that too. And these come not just in a personal way, but in a whole society way. In the whole culture of, our whole American culture has a very strong attitude around this, I have this so I deserve it, and I deserve to keep it. Another societal view that we hold is that because we are capable of using nature to produce things that we want, that we have the right to use nature to produce things that we want. And then there's the whole realm of what we might call metaphysical views. Views about the ultimate nature of being and the world. So what's this? What is the issue? What is the problem with views? One of the first in terms of self-view, in terms of views of who we are and what we're capable of, at the most obvious level, we box ourselves in terms of, because we think we're capable of certain things and not capable of other things, as a self-fulfilling prophecy almost, we aren't capable of things. Or that belief makes it so. Most of us have been subject to this kind of belief from others, that we have a sense of somebody believing or not believing in us, believing that we do certain things a certain way, and we feel boxed in by the beliefs and views that others hold of us. And yet we do that same thing to ourselves. And we also are guilty of boxing others in by the views we hold of them. So in terms of our personal views, our views of who we are and who others are, they form a kind of a self-limitation. So letting go of those views opens us to a possibility that we might be other than we think we are. In terms of our views around the world, our views around others, one of the dangers of views has to do with our imposition of our views on other people. The Buddha says, "Those attached to perceptions and views roam the world offending people." The Buddha also talks about views as being a primary source of disputes, of quarrels. He says that one who adheres to views, holds them tenaciously, and relinquishes them with difficulty has this root of dispute in their psyche. And the Buddha often described the drawbacks, or one of the main drawbacks of views, or drawbacks of attachment to views, as being this engagement in quarrels and disputes, leading to fights, leading to even coming to blows, leading to murder, leading to war. So the danger, there's a great danger in attachment to views, particularly the strong attachment around adhering to views, not being able to relinquish them easily. That leads us into great conflict with each other. Two people who hold opposing views. This is true. What you believe is wrong. No, this is true. What you believe is wrong. Will tend to come to conflict. We can all think of examples of this in our own lives and see the obvious examples of this in our world in forms of terrorism, war, discrimination. A more subtle danger of holding on to views is described by the Buddha as being obsessed with thinking about one's views. In particular, speculation about the world, speculation about how things are in the world. So this is really around the metaphysical views of how the world is put together, ways that the world is seen to be. So in one teaching, the Buddha says that when one speculates about the world in this way, around the nature of the cosmos, is it infinite, is it finite, this leads one to become obsessed with thinking, and that it is not possible to see things as they are when one is obsessed with thinking. So views in general obscure things as they are. One of the ways that views work is that when we are looking through a particular view of the world, what we see tends to confirm that view, which then reinforces the view. The view serves as a kind of a filter, screening out things that don't match with the view, and taking in things that do match with the view. So when we see things through a view, almost inherently, we are not seeing the whole picture. So we're not seeing things as they are. So a few weeks ago, I talked about the Kalamas, and the Kalamas had questions about who to believe, that people came through with all these different views that they were sharing, and they contradicted each other, so how do they know what to believe? And the Buddha said something along the lines of, don't go by view, by teachings, by tradition, by texts, by teachers, etc. So he pointed to ways in which we tend to form views in that sutta. So I'd like to talk just a little bit about some of the ways, particular ways, not all of them by any means, but some of the ways that views form for us, how they come to be. Because I think that understanding how they come to be can help us to see them a little more easily in our own experience. So one way I think that views form is when we are told repeatedly that something is so. Implicitly or explicitly. So, for example, an example of this is that we are told, I think, over and over again through watching our commercials, hearing them on the radio, that if we have these things, then we'll be happy. Over and over again, we get that message. Over and over again, we're told, having things makes you happy. That, coupled with the fact that when we get something that we want, we do have a moment of happiness, makes it especially tenacious, that view. It seems to be confirmed by our experience. We get something, we are happy for a moment. Another way views are formed, perhaps, is when we are told something by a reliable source. This I think is along the lines of what the Buddha was talking about when he said, you know, don't necessarily just go by what a teacher says. So I came up with an example of this, which is kind of a mundane example, but I think it shows the point of how this might happen. When I was a child, I took an art class. And my teacher was pretty good at teaching us about color. And at one point we were drawing apples a lot. And she really taught us how to see the color of the apple and how it changed with the light on it and went from the darker on the outside to the just pure white right at the spot where a light hit it. And so she really helped us to see that. And so we were sitting there drawing our apples, and when some of us drew apples that weren't perfectly symmetrical, she came over and she said we had to redraw them. She said, all apples are perfectly symmetrical. And we thought, I'm sure I've seen apples that don't look perfectly round. But she made us redraw them all. And one day, one young student brought in an apple that was it was quite lopsided, and put it on her desk. Not saying anything about the apple, but just kind of putting it there. And she didn't say a word. And my sense was that she thought, oh, how sweet, he's bringing me an apple. You know, a student bringing me an apple, and didn't even see the fact that it was skewed. Now, I don't know how this happened for her, but I can kind of construct a way in which it might have happened in thinking about it. The other day, I was cutting an apple, and this example came to mind. And I tend to cut my apples along a line of symmetry. There is a line of symmetry in the apples, where if you cut them in half roughly, you get two mirror images of each other. And I thought, you know, I could imagine that she was told in some biology class or read in some text that apples grow symmetrically, and then misunderstood what symmetrical means, thinking it meant perfectly round as opposed to a line of symmetry that you can draw through the apple and get two mirror image halves of each other. It's roughly symmetrical in my understanding, not perfectly symmetrical. But in any case, you know, she formed this view, or she perhaps formed this view based on this input and a misunderstanding of what symmetrical means, and then couldn't see, how could she not have known apples were not perfectly round? I mean, it's so obvious. I mean, you get so many apples in your shopping cart that are not perfectly round. How could she have missed this fact? The views screen out the information. Believing something has the impact of having us miss information in the world, miss things as they are. Views also come out of our direct experience. And the Buddha actually cautioned us about this. There's a story that the Buddha tells, and this is a very familiar teaching story, so I'm sure most of you have heard of it. It's the story of the blind man and the elephant. And in the story, there's a king who asks that all the blind people in the kingdom be gathered and shown an elephant. And some of the blind people are shown the legs, and some of them are, through touching, they're shown the legs. Some are shown the side of the elephant, some the tail, some the ears, some the tusks, some the trunk. And after they've all explored that part of the elephant, they come back, and the king says, so describe an elephant to me. And the people who explored the legs said, well, an elephant's like a post. And the people who explored the side of the elephant said, well, an elephant's like a storeroom. The people who touched the tail said it's like a broom, etc. And in that, because they had felt for themselves, this is what an elephant is like, they formed strong views, and they came to quarrels about it. They said, no, an elephant's like this. An elephant's not like that. An elephant's like a post. It's not like a storeroom. An elephant's like a broom. It's not like a post. So this story is really cautioning us around creating and attaching to views even out of our direct experience. that while we may be perceiving accurately what we have come in contact with, we are probably not picking up the whole picture. In our experience of the world, our usual way of taking in information is actually pretty limited. And it also is compounded by this issue of having views that we see things through, leading us to tend to miss certain bits of information. So even creating views out of our own experience has some danger to it. Then there's views that come out of incorrect perception. Our perceptual process itself is actually quite prone to error. The way I look at it, it's kind of this matching process in the mind, that when it sees something it doesn't understand, or when some information comes in, first of all, it tries to go through its stored history of things and to figure out what does it match. And often it'll just come up with the closest match and say, oh, okay, that's what that is. This kind of error is particularly unfortunate, insidious, in the case of eyewitness misidentification. I heard a story on NPR about a woman who had been raped, and she was shown a lineup of witnesses and pointed to one of the people in that lineup as being the person who had raped her. And over time, the belief that he was the person was confirmed by the fact that she saw his face in her memory. When she remembered that the night of being raped, she clearly saw his face, completely believing that he was the one who raped her. And some years later, DNA tests proved he was not the one that raped her and actually conclusively identified another person as the rapist. So she was actually shocked, you know, that her own perception and her it's like her own memories had been altered to fall in line with that belief. So our perceptual process is prone to error, and we will form views, we'll form beliefs based on things we've perceived, based on this very, what's the right word? Inaccurate processing mechanism in our minds. And then there are views created out of meditative experience. These are particularly hard to shake. And they can be very strong. You see something in a deep state of concentration, there's a kind of a sense of truth to what you've experienced because of the depth of the openness of the mind. That depth of openness of the mind, I think, also makes it more prone to believing what has been seen. And again, I think this is more along the lines of not necessarily that things are misperceived, but that one is perceiving one piece and not seeing a bigger picture. So the Buddha says that experiences in meditation are one of the main sources for metaphysical beliefs, for metaphysical views, for the creation of metaphysical views. So, views seem to be in the way of seeing things as they are. So if seeing things as they are is about letting go of views, then what is wise view about the first aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path? A simple description of the path might be, the Buddha at one point said in brief that the path could be described as nothing should be clung to as I, me, or mine. This includes views. So there seems to be a little paradox here. If the culmination of this path of wisdom is wise view, wise understanding, isn't that just another view that obscures things as they are? So, in my own exploration of this, in my own thinking, and in my looking through the suttas on this, there's a few ways that this paradox is kind of navigated. I think the first way, or the first thing to notice about the view of the first aspect of the Eightfold Path is that it is not a view that's concerned with metaphysical questions. It's a view that's concerned with how suffering is formed in the present moment. So it's more of a pragmatic view, a view that is to be used to engage in a practice, than it is a view that is meant to be believed. So I think that's a big distinction, that the view, the right view, the wise view of the Eightfold Path is not simply meant to be believed. It's a set of actions, actually. The teaching on wise view is that one with wise view understands the Four Noble Truths, which is essentially, again, not something to believe, but rather something to act on. We are encouraged to understand suffering, to let go of the clinging or craving that causes suffering, to realize for ourselves the release from suffering, and to cultivate the path that leads to the end of suffering. So this isn't about belief, this is about action. And at first, also, this truth is, or the wise view of the Eightfold Path is adopted as a belief in a way. It is adopted in, we have it as enough of a belief in order that we take the actions that it recommends. Because without some form of belief, of faith, that these statements would yield results, it's hard to actually begin. So there is a form of faith, a form of belief in these truths. And this takes the form of reflecting on these teachings and contemplating them, thinking about them. So hearing them and contemplating them. So using this conceptual understanding, we engage in a practice of observing clinging and observing the consequences of clinging. Seeing for ourselves, when we observe the clinging, that it leads to suffering. The consequences of clinging are suffering. So it's a very direct impact here. So we engage in practices that support this letting go of views, in fact. And one of the main recommendations, kind of the most obvious recommendation that the Buddha makes around how to train in letting go of views, is to not engage in quarrels and disputes. Quarrels and disputes being one of the main outcomes of holding on to views. So abandoning that outcome supports a little bit more ease in letting go of attachment to views. And then, using the view that clinging causes suffering, even clinging to views causes suffering. Again, from the Buddha. Now, how would one, led on by desire, entrenched in his likes, forming his own conclusions, overcome his own views? He'd dispute in line with the way he knows. Now, this is an interesting passage, and it's often used to point to the fact that the way we use views to shore up our own opinions. That when we have a view, when we're entrenched in a view, then all of our disputes, all of our beliefs, how would we overcome that view? Because everything that we take in confirms that view. But I also think this verse points to a way out for us. I mean, we all cling to views. How do we overcome clinging to views? The way one might be able to overcome a clinging to views is to hold a view or to use a view that clinging to views is not helpful. And then observe the clinging. Again, coming into the direct experience, not using it as a belief, but using it as an in-the-moment exploration. There's a sutta that basically describes a conversation with one of the Buddha's followers, actually not a monk, a person who was a householder, a person who was a follower who was dedicated but wasn't an ordained monastic. And he came upon all of these other people, from wanderers from other sects of the day. And they asked him some questions. They said, tell us, Ananda Pindika, what views does the Buddha have? And he said, well, I can't tell you precisely what views the Buddha has. And they said, oh, okay, well, tell us what views the monks have. And he said, I can't tell you that either. Well, tell us what views you have. Well, I can do that. But first, tell me the views that you have, and then I will tell you the views that I have. And so they each went on to proclaim their views, all of which were in this metaphysical realm. One of them said, the cosmos is eternal. Only this is true. Anything else is worthless. This is the sort of view I have. Another said, the cosmos is not eternal. Only this is true. Anything else is worthless. This is the sort of view I have. And then they went on, each of them proclaiming a different view. The cosmos is finite, the cosmos is infinite, the soul and the body are the same, the soul is one thing, the body is another, etc. All of them saying, only this is true, anything else is worthless. This is the sort of view I hold. So this really pointing to that real tenacious kind of clinging, that only this is true. So Ananda Pindika, after they each said their view, said, as for the Venerable One who says, the cosmos is eternal, only this is true, anything else is worthless, this is the sort of view I have, his view arises from his own inappropriate attention or independence on the words of another. Now this view has been brought into being, is fabricated, willed, dependently originated. Whatever has been brought into being is fabricated, willed, dependently originated. That is inconstant. whatever is in constant is stress. The Venerable One thus adheres to that very stress, submits himself to that very stress, and likewise for all the other views. So then they said, well, tell us the views that you have. And he says, whatever has been brought into being is fabricated, willed, dependently originated. That is inconstant. Whatever is inconstant is stress. Whatever is stress is not me, is not what I am, is not myself. That is the sort of view I have. And they tried using his same argument on him. So, whatever has been brought into being is fabricated, willed, dependently originated. That is inconstant. Whatever is inconstant is stress. You thus adhere to that very stress. Submit yourself to that very stress. And he responds saying, having seen this well with right discernment as it is actually present, I also discern the higher escape from it as it is actually present. So holding this kind of view allows a kind of escape hatch to observe any view as something that is simply arising in the present moment. Whatever is arising in the present moment is created, formed out of causes and conditions, is destined to disappear. Clinging to that will cause suffering. Seeing that in the moment is different than holding a belief, believing something to be true. This calls to mind the analogy of the raft, if you're familiar with this analogy, where the Buddha talked about his teachings as being like crossing over a river on a raft, and that the teachings were like the raft, that they were used in order to cross over the river. But once you got across the river, there was no point in carrying the raft around on your head, that it's time to put the raft down. So he says at the end of this discourse, I have declared the Dhamma to be like a raft for the purposes of crossing over, not for the purposes of clinging. That even the teachings are not to be clung to as views, as ideas. They are used for purposes of action, of investigation in the present moment. So, as we explore this way, using the teachings to explore, we come to a deeper understanding, not just a reflective understanding of the teachings, not just a reflective understanding of wise view, but an actual shift of understanding. Not a concept, but what it means to see our experience as it actually is. One scholar says, when the texts teach that one should strive to attain right view, they are arguing for the attainment of a very specific attitude, a way of apprehending things without any form of attachment. Right view is not simply another view as opposed to wrong view, nor is it the rejection of all views. The opposite of wrong view is of a different nature, not a mere correction, but a different order of seeing. So those are some thoughts on views.